So think of this as almost like a college-style lecture on John Owen and the Puritan era. Typically, what I will do in preparation for one of these intro lectures is I will actually read an entire biography on the author. I didn't have the time to do that one this time around. So I feel like I'm a little bit less prepared on John Owen than I have been in the past with some of the other authors. But I'm hoping that maybe a couple of you are knowledgeable of Owen. I took a class on him in seminary, so I did spend a lot of time reading his stuff when I was in grad school. But that's going back about 10 years now. So, all right. So let's do this. For those who are veterans of Theology at the Tap Room, we're not all trying to come in here and have all the exact same ideas. This is a place where you can discuss great works of theology, great writers of theology, and do so in such a way where it's okay to disagree. I've always felt like there aren't very many places, oftentimes, in churches where it's not only acceptable, but it's encouraged to disagree and to be able to have those kind of conversations. And so I wanted to be able to create a place where we could do that. So that's part of what's behind Theology at the Tap Room. It's also my goal that we read a lot of different authors from different eras of Christian history and covering different key doctrines. So quick rundown of some of the books we've read. Dorothy Sayers, Mind of the Maker. She was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis. Let's see, we read St. Augustine's Confessions. Help me out, guys. We've done Aquinas. Apostolic Fathers, so that's more of a Greek Orthodox tradition there. Newbegin, Martin Luther. Did you say Bono? Bonhoeffer. I'm like, Bono, he's not dead, man. We can only read people that are dead. Am I missing any?
Lewis,
yeah, thank you. Last time around, we read C.S. Lewis. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, Orthodoxy. So a lot of wide variety of authors. Actually, a little bit heavy on the Catholic side. A lot of the great authors. Obviously, there's a lot more Catholic history than there is not Catholic history, so that makes sense. Jeff alluded to the fact that we alternate between books written in the modern era or after, depending on whether or not you want to call this still the modern era, and then pre-modern. And one of the reasons we do that is, one, just to kind of keep things fresh, but also because pre-modern books tend to be longer, and we tend to do those in the winter-spring semester because we can go a little bit longer on this. And modern-era books tend to be a little bit shorter. So we do those in the fall because we generally only have like November or October, November, December for discussion months. So we kind of alternate that way. What we typically do is the first night is an intro lecture, and then after that you come prepared to discuss about 75 pages. With this book, I've actually dropped it down significantly. You saw the breakdown on your sheet, 45 pages, 37 pages, 35 pages. We may go into May. We can talk about that as we get closer. So much lower than normal, and that's because Owen is really thick. I mean, we're talking sentences that, like, you're trying to figure out, like, where did this sentence begin? Because I feel like I haven't seen a period in a few pages, and I'm trying to figure it out. So that's kind of how Owen writes. And yet it all makes sense, actually, if you break it down. When I took Owen in seminary, when I took the class on Owen, one of the projects that our professor made us do, he picked like kind of a stereotypical long John Owen sentence, and he had us diagram it just to prove that like it actually did make sense. You just had to like read it through and diagram it out, and you're like, oh, I can totally see it. It makes total sense. I just wish the guy would learn how to use a period every now and then, a little more than most of the book. So anyway, the other thing about Theology at the Tap Room is that I really like to make sure people understand that this is not a Terra Nova Church thing. In fact, I think there's at least four or five people here from other churches, so that's great. I always encourage that, and it's, you know, I'm a pastor at Terra Nova Church, and probably typically 2/3 of the people that are here are from Terra Nova Church, but by all means, it's not a Terra Nova thing, and so we're glad to have different perspectives. I love it when there's people coming from very different church perspectives and bringing that into the discussion. Things that are critically important to somebody in, say, more of a high church environment are not nearly as important to somebody like me. Terra Nova is considered low church in terms of kind of how that's broken down. And so, well, it is. It's just talking about like very liturgical churches versus not liturgical churches, although we have some pieces of ancient upgrade at Terra Nova. But it's good to kind of have different perspectives on that, right, and bring that into the discussion. And I love that, and I would encourage you as we get into the discussion through the study to bring those perspectives in. Don't homogenize this. You know, let's keep it interesting and bring up your history, bring up your past from other churches that you've been a part of, and it helps you kind of see it through different lenses. So please do that. Let me touch on our next book before we do this. Jeff Murrell and I sat down in December and worked out the next two studies, this one and the next one. And the next book that we'll read in the fall is J. Gresham Machen's Christianity and Liberalism. And this is a classic work that was written to combat the early hit of liberalism in the 1920s, kind of the God is Dead movement. And so this was viewed as the book that it's actually viewed as the book that killed old liberalism. Old liberalism is kind of this term that refers to that era in the 20s and 30s. And this book is viewed as the book that really kind of cut the legs out from underneath it. And it actually has a lot of interesting things to say about today's world as well. So I think this will be a really great book. It's the title can make it sound like it's kind of a jerky book. You know what I mean? Like oh, Christianity and liberalism, right? But it's not. It's actually not that way at all. It's just kind of a defense of classic Christianity, of Orthodox truth, in a time when anything was up for grabs, which has continued on until today. But this is a really great book on that. So that's what we're going to do in the fall. I have no idea what we're going to do next winter. We'll figure that out when we get a little bit closer. All right, let's look at these ground rules here. A few things to keep in mind on the sheet. Some of this is old hat to the veterans, but we'll go over it anyway. Here's the deal on Theology at the Taproom is that I know this is hard, okay? I don't expect this to be the kind of thing that everybody can take part in. The place to go for developing community with each other, for hearing each other's prayer requests, etc., is a tribe or a small group, whatever your church, however your church does that. This is designed to be kind of the place where we can get into some tough theology. And so unlike, say, a Bible study that you might be in at Terra Nova or in your church, where there's multiple goals in that Bible study, one of them being just developing community with each other. Because of those other goals, sometimes you can show up to a Bible study, and if you've had a really busy week, you might not have prepared for it, right? You might not have read the passage or done the questions ahead of time. You feel bad about it. You try to hide it. But you go anyway because you know that it's not just about the study. It's also about hearing each other's needs, confessing sins to one another, worshiping together, praying together, being together. So there's other goals in mind. When it comes to Theology at the Taproom, it's really critical that you do all of the reading and that you come prepared to discuss it. And so if you can't commit to that, it's totally cool to not come back. And I won't be upset with you or offended or anything like that. It just means that it's not the right time for you right now. So try again later on. It's totally, totally fine. Number two, the tap room pays their staff with money. Spend some each time you're here. So they don't charge us a room rental on this room. The way they make their money on that is just through our food. So just, you know, do something small. It's all, you know, you don't have to get anything major. If you plan on drinking, know your limit. If your sentences start rambling like John Owens, you've had too much, right? So every now and then I'll get questions from people outside of Terra Nova about, you know, the fact that we do this thing called Theology at the Tap Room, and there's some judgmental tones there at times, assuming that we're all just drunk here, I don't know, discussing theology. But I try to explain that that Jeff is the only one who ever... No, I'm just kidding. people generally respect that, and I've never seen anybody have too much, but I like to say it anyway just because it's important, given the context of our study here. Right, number four, bring cash. It's just easier for everybody when they bring a couple of checks over to each table. We're not trying to... Give her 12 credit cards. It's just kind of a pain. So there's a ATM downstairs. So please represent Terra Nova well when you are here. Only heretics tip poorly, tip 20% or more. They really do view, just for those who aren't a part of Terra Nova, they really do view this as a Terra Nova group. They don't know that a third of you aren't from Terra Nova. And we really try to cultivate our relationships with our neighbors here on the block. We just always want to make sure that when they see Terra Nova coming, they're glad that we're coming. So tip well. Number six, very important. Do not embarrass us by ordering light beer. And that's it. Okay.
Yeah, that's the only reason I've ever seen Phil ask someone to leave.
Right. Ordered a Coors Light. I'm like, seriously? What, is this like a NASCAR event? Get out of here. So, you can't do that here. All right. So you see the breakdown here. And let me walk you through why we're doing the breakdown that way. You'll see that we're only reading 123 pages, and yet the book is significantly longer than that. So the reason why we're doing this is that the first book, what constitutes book one and two, is really the meat of the argument. And then the way that authors of his day would write is they would basically make their argument, and that's what we see in book one and two. And then later on in the rest of the book, they'll take a lot of time to kind of like add in all these other pieces. And so with that in mind, and knowing how difficult an author Owen is to read, how long it takes compared to others, I figured I would chop it down a little bit and have us just do a smaller amount, and it worked out well to just read book one and two. Obviously, you're welcome to go on and read book three and four on your own. If we decide to go into May, then we'll probably just pick out a portion, 40 pages of something, and we'll just decide that, you know, in April and come back in May and do that. But I think you'll get a really good overview of Owen's thought process and writing style and kind of what his big deal is. In 125 pages, so it should be good. All right. First night, 45 pages, then we've got 37 and 35 thereafter. Okay. Well, let's get into talking about John Owen. Well, John Owen was born in 1616, died in 1683, so 67 years of life is pretty good in those days when disease was common. Owen was one of the most important Puritan theologians of his day in England. And the Puritan era was a pretty funky time religiously. A lot of what we're going to talk about tonight really has more to do with the Puritan era and less with John Owen himself, because I think it's important to understand kind of what he was writing in. You think about what was going on in England in the time. You have a country that is emerging from being a strictly Catholic country to being something much, much more than that, much wider than that. And it's not unlike the pains of childbirth. That process had been going on for a little while, but it was like it just kept on going on. It just didn't seem to end. It just kept on, this process of breaking away just didn't seem to end. Try to imagine a time when if you are a Christian, you were Catholic. Like, that was it. There were no other options. If you were a Christian, you were Catholic, except for the Greek Orthodox Church, but they were kind of off on their own. And, you know, this is a time when, remember, there isn't internet, there isn't newspapers, there's no communication other than what a ship brings from one place to another. So it's not like ideas were passing super fast. And so really it was Catholic or nothing. Now try to imagine a day also when the government told you what you believed about God, right? So they told you who God was. They told you how to worship. They told you how the church would function from a hierarchical standpoint, from a leadership standpoint. That was decided by the government, not by a church body. And the time reminds me of a movie, and I couldn't pull the name of it back, but maybe somebody will be able to help me out. It reminds me of a movie where it starts off in black and white. These people are watching like 1950s sitcom television, and everything's in black and white, right? And they get pulled into like the TV world, and they're in black and white, but then like they start to bring color to it. Anybody know? No, there was another one similar to it. What's that?
Wizard of Oz.
No, seriously, there's another one. Anyway, because Pleasantville, wasn't Pleasantville the one where...
No, the one through self-discovery and discovering of all their individual personalities.
And there's like colors start popping up everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah,
see, I was thinking it was a different one, because I was thinking maybe it's Pleasantville. Anyway, all right, so it's Pleasantville, great. But you know, in that movie, right, like they start to see all these colors, and it's like the whole world is opened up to them. They just don't even know what to do. Some people are just totally freaking out by all these new colors, and some of them are embracing it. Some of them are just going wild. That's kind of what's going on in the church culture of the day. It used to be just Catholic, and now there's like all these other colors to check out. And you're like, what is going on here? You know, that's kind of what's going on in the religious culture of the day. And so that's when Owen is writing. They're well into that era. So that's when Owen's writing. Previous to the Reformation era, there was just that one choice, right? You were Catholic or you were Catholic. Right? That was it. Then the Reformation introduced the idea that you could believe in the God of the Bible without being an official Roman Catholic Church member. Lots found it unsettling. Some found it heretical, but others found a lot of freedom in it. And you had all sorts of books being published with this relatively new invention called the printing press. And suddenly, ideas were traveling faster than ever before. Because before this, right, you would need to either hand write things, or you had to have the originator of the ideas bring them to you, right? Or somebody that he had trained. But now, with books becoming more and more common, you could print ideas and transport them all over the place. And a whole world is opening up. It becomes much harder to kill those ideas, right? If you are, say, a leader of in the government, and you wanted to squelch an idea previous to the printing press, you just killed that person. It was done, right? You didn't have to, you know, maybe they had a few followers who kept their ideas going for a little while, but by and large, that was it. But now you're able to publish books, you're able to put ideas around, you can kill the author, but the ideas may very well keep on going and may actually galvanize when you kill that author. So ideas are living on. Well, the Reformation had begun well before the Puritan era, and while some embrace Reformation ideas for truly religious reasons, lots are figuring out that Reformation ideas were their ticket out of an oppression or a taxation or a control that happened through the Catholic Church. The monarchs of the day had a tenuous relationship with the Catholic Church. At times they loved them, and at times they were annoyed that they were always being kind of asked for another thing, or you know, they were kind of going back and forth. Sometimes it seemed like the Catholic Church was actually determining who was a king, and sometimes it seemed like the king was determining who was in charge of the Catholic Church, and so it was kind of funky. It was this weird mixing of religious and political powers, and it wasn't always healthy, and it definitely was not. Generally, whoever was in charge liked it at the time, and the other person didn't like it, right? So monarchs started looking at Reformation ideas and saying, interesting. So right now, it kind of seems like the Catholic Church has a lot of power over me. But if I embrace these Reformation ideas, then suddenly I don't have as much power being exacted over me. And so they like that. And some of the Reformation ideas were even saying, like, listen, the real power should rest in the king. And so this was certainly good for a lot of the kings. So you've got a lot of different ideas floating around, and it was impacting all of the kings of the day throughout England and Scotland and all the various countries in that area throughout Europe. And so you've got all of that going on. And in that is the Puritan Revolution. England had definitely co-opted Reformation ideas to strengthen the power of the government and more importantly, the king. And so decisions were made by the government about matters of religion because they would allow for various political alliances, right? So instead of saying, this is what we believe about the Bible or this is what we truly believe the church should be like, oftentimes the decisions that the people in charge were making had more to do with, if we make this theological statement, then this group will be happy with us, and then we'll be able to have this political alliance. And so religious decisions were being made for political expediency. All right. Remember that the idea of religious freedom, like we understand today, was not even a consideration. Okay, so it's not like people were fighting for true religious freedom of all sorts. They were fighting at best for the ability to worship the God of the Bible in a slightly different way. But more often than not, they were fighting for the right to force everyone else to worship God in the way that they saw fit. And understand here that I'm not talking about, like this person's Muslim and this person's Jewish and this person's Christian and wouldn't it be nice if everybody could worship as they saw fit. That's not the kind of religious freedom that they're arguing for. They're arguing for we think you should have bishops, but these people think there should be a pope, and these people think that there should only be local pastors, and we're going to fight about that. And then once we figure out what we think is right, then we're going to make everybody else do that the same. So that's kind of the fights that were going on. And with each new king or new war or new rules that were passed, with each new change there, the church would also change along with it. And the way that the church functioned, the way that it governed itself, all of these things would change. So you kind of felt like a ping pong if you were, in the church in that day, or especially if you were in leadership. It was just like every few years, it seemed like there was another change. Whoever had the king's ear would cause a change. Then the king would be killed, and so there was a change. Or the king would die, and there was a change. And then there was no king, and there was a change. And then there was a king, and then they kicked the king off to another country, and then there was a change. And it was just constantly, right? So this was kind of the religious world of the day. One of the big things that people were arguing about was how the church should be led. This was a very big issue. The old Catholic way of a pope and bishops had seen really significant abuses by some men who had just decided that power was more important. And so there was a lot of extravagance amongst bishops and other ecclesiastical leaders in the Catholic Church. And so a lot of people wanted to get away from that. Now, when England pushed more towards an episcopal look, what we know today, the Church of England, they definitely embraced an idea similar to that of a hierarchy like you find in the Catholic Church. And there were quite a few abuses there as well. Not as many, but still plenty. And that's one of the reasons why we have this Puritan Revolution going on, was because they said, no, we don't need to have this anymore. We don't need to have this big system where there's people who are, just being treated like royalty and don't seem to be doing a whole lot. So do we really need this system? Can we break away from this? Do we need all the gold? Do we need all the jewels? Let's break away from that. So bishops were not very, very popular amongst the Puritans. That was one thing they could agree on. There were a lot of things where the Puritans disagreed with each other. You can't think of the Puritans as, if you say, these are the Catholics and these are the Protestants and these are the Greek Orthodox, or these are Jews, and these are Muslims. You can't categorize Puritans into one simple group, because there's a lot of variation amongst them, probably more so than most religious cultures. All right, so many, including John Owen, argued for a more Presbyterian form of government, with local elders or pastors leading the congregation. They would still be tied to an official church. There was always an official church in England, and there still is. It's just that it was a matter of how did that church function at that time. So that was Owen's personal conviction, that it should be more Presbyterian in nature. But in practice, he was what was called an independent. At that time, independents believed that local congregations should basically be left alone to do things as they see fit and only really be bothered on big issues. And so Owen, in practice, functioned more like an independent, but in his gut, he preferred a Presbyterian form of government. Owen got his big break during a critical period in church history and English history. There was a period when the king had essentially been deposed, and instead Oliver Cromwell was named as Lord Protector. And someone tell us a little bit about Oliver Cromwell, someone who knows about Cromwell.
He led a revolution in England, deposed and executed the king.
He did indeed.
Thousands of Irish Catholics.
Yes, he enjoyed killing Irish Catholics, or seeing to their murder. He led a revolution, and he was named Lord Protector for a period. And so he was actually asked if he would like to take the title of king, and he refused it, although it was kind of like a no, please don't, sort of that kind of a thing, right? So he never did take the title of king, and honestly, the only reason they offered him the title of king is because they knew that his reign was going to be so short. They're like, just call him king, what the heck, you know? So he refused it because he really wanted kind of this utopian society. Okay, so Owen got his big break during this critical period in church history and English history. There was this time when Cromwell had been deposed. He's functioning as, or Cromwell is, had deposed the king. He's functioning as Lord Protector. He's trying to set up a system of representative government, but it never really came about. And even when he did do it, it was Cromwell was in charge. Everyone kind of knew that. In reality, Cromwell probably acted kind of like a benevolent despot, and not much better than that. The important thing to note is that Cromwell noticed Owen. He heard Owen preach and asked him to be his chaplain on military expeditions. So they became friends, and Owen became almost like an advisor to this de facto ruler of England. In 1651, the Parliament in London makes, I guess they weren't functioning in London at that time, but the Parliament makes Owen the Dean of Christ Church in Oxford, and later Vice Chancellor of Oxford University. But Cromwell's rule did not last long, and when the Protectorate, as it was called, ended, Owen was kicked out of Christ Church and moved to London, where he went on preaching and writing. Later on, when Charles II was restored to the throne, Owen surprisingly found a welcoming from him and from this ruler. And actually, Charles II helped him in providing support to multiple ejected Puritan ministers. So he kind of was helping him out there. Another big issue for Owen and for many in the Puritan movement was an attempt to make the liturgy universally the same. Remember I said that the government really controlled the church, and that went so far as to say, when you get up for the service and you stand in front of these people, you don't decide what you're going to say. We'll tell you what you're going to say. So on week one, here's what you say. On week two, here's what you say. And this was just a further way of controlling controlling the church and controlling the people's ideas, what they believed. That's sort of liturgy taken to an extreme, right? So I'm a fan of liturgy. I like the beauty of it. I like the history of it. At Terra Nova, we'll pull in some kind of pieces of it with responsive readings and whatnot. Some of you might come from a church where liturgy is the norm, where there's a book that is used, and that's. But then there's always, you know, in, at least in today's church culture, even in churches that really use liturgy a lot, there's generally a place where you can the pastor or priest minister can say a few of his own words in explanation of it, kind of bringing it into today's culture, right? That even happens in the Catholic Church today, because the Catholic Church today that we see was reformed from what it was in Luther's day, in Owen's day. But the idea was if we can control the liturgy, if we can keep it tight and decide what's going to be said, then we can make sure that that your words are only what we want you to say, and then we can control the thoughts of the people. And so this was a big issue for Owen and for other Puritans. They didn't want that. They wanted people to be able to worship as with a little more freedom. The person who was pushing for this a lot was Archbishop Laud. And he did so because he really did not want the very popular Calvinist views of salvation to continue spreading. Calvin was one of the reformers, and his ideas were popular. And they wanted to put a stop to it by limiting the words that could be spoken. Owen opposed this and felt that worship should be a little more free-flowing. And Owen, you'll see, is, as you read his writing, you'll definitely see that he is a Calvinist. And actually, his first book was against Arminianism. 4 years later, 1648, he would write the book that we're going to read, Death of Death, which will deal with the nature of redemption and more specifically the idea of limited atonement. And in fact, this book is still considered one of the best books ever written on this subject by many. And it's one of the best expressions of Reformed theology, especially when you consider that it was written to defend what is, quite honestly, the weakest point of Calvinist theology. And I'm saying that as somebody who's like a four-point Calvinist. And I should say also at the outset that I don't agree with all that Owen's going to say in this book. I rarely agree with everything that an author says in any book, but I definitely don't agree with everything he's going to say in here. The baseline idea that Owen's going to deal with here is what happened on the cross. From a theologically legal standpoint, kind of use that language, what did Christ accomplish on the cross? And we'll spend a lot of time talking about sufficiency versus, anyone know? Anyone? No? Efficacy. Sufficiency versus efficacy. Some will point out that Karl Barth made similar statements when he talked about the divine initiative, but Owen's theology, Karl Barth is writing much later than Owen, but where Owen's theology led him to say that only a percentage of all mankind would ultimately be saved, have their sin atoned for, Barth is forced into more of a universalist position that all will ultimately be saved. But the kernel idea of divine initiative is there in both of their theology. So it's kind of interesting. If somebody else has studied Barth much, I'd love to, when we get there, I'd love to have that as part of our discussion, kind of contrasting those two. Well, another issue that Owen was asked to deal with in his writings was the rise of a group called the Socinians. Socinians were the original Unitarians and essentially challenged the divinity of Jesus by questioning his relationship with God. And so Owen was hired to, he was hired actually, like they, like the, basically the government or this group of leaders hired him to say, okay, you need to, you know, kind of put the smack down on the Socinians. And so he was hired to respond to the writings of John Biddle. Now, the interesting thing is that later on, Owen will concede somewhat to the ideas of the Socinians in saying that while he disagrees with where the Socinians end up, he can agree that the standard line of sort of the standard church line on the nature of Jesus was lacking. And here's what he's going to say. He's going to say, look, the reality is Jesus' sonship that we see in the Bible seems to indicate that he was just as dependent on the Holy Spirit as we are, and that Jesus was open to temptation and trial just like us. Now, for us, we might hear that and say, well, yeah, I mean, that seems pretty clear. I mean, if we've read the Bible at all, we see that in there. But remember that in Owen's day, the sources of authority are not just the Bible. The sources of authority are also a strong sense of tradition, right? So church tradition holds almost as much, and in some cases more, authority than the Bible itself, because there's an idea that men of God have interpreted the Bible, and therefore we now place their interpretation as just as important, if not more important, than the actual words. And also remember that they are, as a culture, not nearly as removed from being Catholic only as we are, right? So we're sitting here in 2011, hundreds of years away from the Reformation. They're sitting there in 1648, what, 100 years away from it, roughly? So they're much closer. And so whatever comes out of Catholicism is going to look pretty darn Catholic, right? Because it's what they know. And so the church in England is still going to look pretty Catholic. And so they're going to have some of the baggage left over from that. So people are going to look more Catholic than they are Protestant, even though technically they're all Protestants, except for those that were arguing for a return to Catholicism, which certainly there were plenty in England still in this day arguing that we should make the national church again, we should bring it back to the Catholic Church and make that the national church. So, you know, we have several hundred more years of protesting, right, of being Protestants to get us where we are today. We're very removed from the Catholic Church in that sense. We have a lot more purifying under our belts. That's the reason why they were called Puritans. They were trying to purify the church, get it back to the Bible, just like the Reformers before them. So, you know, if you think you've got the Reformers and then you've got the Puritans, right? The words are very similar, reforming, purifying, right? Bring it up into more recent movements, the fundamentalist movement, bringing things back to, anybody, you've heard of the fundamentalist movement, 1950s, 40s, going back, actually it's part of what spawned a book like this. Fundamentalists, bringing things back to the fundamentals of the faith. Later on, and right now going on, is the neo-reformed missional movement, of which Terra Nova is a part of. It's attempting to restore both doctrinal clarity based on sound Bible study. Of course, because the neo-reform movement exists in part as a reaction to the emergent movement, there's a strong emphasis on cultural or missional engagement. And that's the reason why the emergent movement has really kind of resurrected the social gospel movement and put aside doctrine in favor of service only. And you might say, well, you're kind of getting off on a tangent here. What I'm really trying to do is I'm trying to place Owen in kind of a wide context of reformers, of purifiers. There's always, with each generation, a group that's going to rise up and say, you know, it seems like we've gotten a little bit astray from what the Bible says or what we see in the New Testament church. How do we get back to that? And that's going to be then framed in terms of cultural needs, societal needs, doctrinal, you know, oddities. It's going to look different in each generation, but it happens in every generation. And it's happened ever since the Reformation. But we're talking about John Owen here, right, and the Puritans. So it's helpful, though, to see John Owen in that wider context of history. So Owen, going back to this Socinian argument, Owen ultimately says that Jesus is both the giver and the receiver of the Spirit, which was a radical idea in that time. Okay, Owen essentially presents a doctrine of Jesus that lines up much more closely with the gospel accounts. Now, I mentioned before this time that it was the government that decided how the church functioned and worshiped. And so when it was expedient to keep good relationships with the Puritans, their voices mattered. But when political winds changed, you could be out just as quickly as you were in. And as a result, Owen's work has not received the kind of attention that it deserves in many segments of the church. Once the Puritans were no longer needed, Owen was kind of dismissed to go and write and preach and do what he wants to do, but he was no longer a voice that mattered in that day. It's worth noting that it's been that after Owen wrote The Death of Death, it was 200 years before anyone else wrote a book that was clearly articulating statements on Jesus as both the Son of God and a man. So his deity and his humanness. It was 200 years before anyone else wrote a book on that. Today, Owen continues to not be known as much in England, and yet is embraced much more in American Reformed circles, partly because he was rediscovered by people like J.I. Packer and kind of made him a little more popular, kind of trumpeted him, wrote some forewords and got his books out there a little more, but also because in America, John Owen doesn't come with the same kind of baggage that he would carry for the Brits. In America, we tend to embrace our Puritan heritage, and we see it as a piece of our history, right? We might talk about the Puritans as people that had funny hats and seemed a little strict, but we also know that they were a key piece of our history, right? But in London, in England, there was almost a desire to kind of pretend that the Puritan Revolution era didn't really happen. Like, it's kind of an embarrassing thing. Like, there was this funky time where we didn't have a king. We had this Lord Protector, and, we didn't have the royalty, which we kind of like because it looks nice on TV, and we like the parades, and Buckingham Palace is kind of fun to visit. And, we just kind of avoid this period. It's just pretend that it doesn't really exist, right? In fact, after Cromwell was killed, he was first buried in... Anybody know this story? Anybody? Go ahead, Josh.
I don't know all the details. Okay. They dug him back up and tried him as a corpse.
Right.
And then beheaded him and then multiple other drawn and quartering.
Yeah, so I was... my wife and I were in London a few years ago, and we went to Westminster Abbey, and the... there's this spot where you can see they've got all these people buried in Westminster Abbey, right? Like, they're like under the floor. And so they've got this spot where you can see, John Owen. He's got his little plot in the floor of Westminster Abbey, and he was buried there. And then they dug him up. They tried him, and then they chopped him up into like 80 pieces and sent him around to various parts of the country, like a little tour or something. I don't know. So they really wanted to undo Oliver Cromwell's... Did I say John Owen? I meant to say Oliver Cromwell. They really wanted to undo Cromwell's time period in British history. Yeah. This is... For America, the Puritan era is a bigger piece of our history, right? We have just a few hundred years of history in America. And so if you chop out 25 years of it, I mean, you've chopped out like 1/16th of our history, right? But you go to England, and they just have a lot more history than us. So, okay, fine, we're going to chop out the Puritan era. Great. It's like, 1/100th, 1/1000th of our history, right? I mean, when I was in the Tower of London, in London there, the tour guide pointed out this wall that was next to the official Tower of London, and said, this wall dates back to the Roman era, right? So, like, they've got a little more history than us, right? So we don't have as much to chop out as they do. But also, we recognize that the Puritans had a huge piece of our history, and their philosophy really helped birth our nation. So we pay a little more interest to it. And I do want to take just a few minutes to kind of tie briefly these two countries together, tie American history together and English history. All right, so pretty early on, you had Puritans leaving Britain for the colonies, right? While people will make it sound like it was all for religious freedom, that the whole reason for this was simply to go and set up the city on the hill and create the religious utopia, that's often a favorite tactic of especially the religious right in American Christianity. It makes for a nice story. You can make it into children's comic books, and it's fine. But the reality is that there were a lot of financial reasons for some of the colonies that were made here on religious purposes. So it was more like there were these wealthy merchant traders who were hoping for trading opportunities, and they worked together with religious dissidents who wanted a way out. So it was kind of like, look, I'll provide the funds, I'll get you a boat, I'll get you all the provisions you're going to need, and, you know, we'll get 100 Puritans, we'll toss them on a boat, we'll get them over to the New World, and, you know, you guys get some trade going for me, and you can have your little religious group there, and that's great. People will leave you alone, and that's fine. Just keep the beaver pelts coming, and we're good. You know, it's fine. It was not quite as altruistic as some will make it out to be. And the Puritans were. This is the interesting thing about this. Oftentimes, the Puritan history of America kind of gets lumped into kind of this homogenous thing where it's all kind of one group of people working together. It's actually pretty messy. Remember that these are the people who disagreed with the status quo and said, you know, I want to do things differently, religiously speaking. In fact, I feel so strongly about it that I will get onto a boat and I will travel across the ocean to go to this new world and live there my way, the way that I want to live. Now, what are the chances that you're going to get a group like that to all be on the same page, right? I mean, these are the people who say, yep, the way it's working here is not working. I'm going somewhere else where I can do it my way. Great. So you get a few thousand people who want to do it my way. Are they going to agree? Of course not. And it was the same back in England, but it was less pronounced because they had a common enemy, right? They had, you know, the bishops. They had the abuses of the crown. So they had some common enemies. But you get over into a colony in America, and suddenly the common enemy is pretty removed. And the boats don't come very often. And so you're kind of on your own. So you don't have that common enemy anymore. So back in England, you had Puritans who were Calvinists, and you had Puritans who were Arminians. Some baptized babies, some did not, and were pretty against baptizing babies. Some wanted pastors or elders to run the church. Some wanted no pastors, just congregational rule. Some wanted bishops, some didn't, most didn't. Some wanted to be connected to something bigger than themselves. Some wanted to be totally separate. Some drank alcohol. Some did not. Some embraced various works of the Spirit. Some did not. It was a mixed bag of dissidents who had a few things in common. And so they come over to the colonies, and it was more of the same thing. You had Massachusetts, which was supposed to be the city on the hill of classic Puritanism. But some didn't like that, and they left, right? So pretty early on, you've got Roger Williams starting Rhode Island, as a Baptist colony, right? This is a state started to be Baptist. So they also argued for religious freedom. And so you've got kind of this weird mix of like, we're Baptist, but we're okay with you not being Baptist. And it's funny, the revisionist history is always fun to watch. Because you'll often hear it said that, like, you know, America was founded on religious freedom, right? You've heard that, right? But remember that what they meant was, you are free to worship the God of the Bible in any way you see fit. Like, however you want, it's totally fine. If you're Muslim, we're going to kill you. If you're anything else, we're going to kill you. But you're free to worship the God of the Bible however you want. It's all fine. In some parts of the colonies, they actually would run you out of town if you worship differently. So actually, like, entire congregations were just asked to leave. Could you leave our colony? We'd rather you not be here. You're kind of messing things up. It's a big country. There's lots of land. Go find some other land. So they would go and start their own town or their own colony. And then normally within a year, there'd be a splinter group from that group that would go and start another town. And so this was kind of how the northern colonies were populated. Was just, you know, this family gets mad and say, you know, you worship a little bit differently than us, so we're going to go over here. So this is what we're born in, right? So that's why when we see our founding fathers put in that phrase, separation of church and state, right? Today, that the way that's typically interpreted is we've got to keep the church out of the state, right? Like, so if a town hall has a manger scene at Christmas time, you know, that's a violation of church and state, right? That's kind of what it's reduced to, is those sorts of things. But for the Puritans and for their descendants and for those who put that phrase in, separation of church and state, what they were looking at was they were saying, look, we got some Baptists, we've got some Presbyterians, we've got, you know, these Congregationalists, and, you know, we've got these guys are worshiping over in this colony and we're worshiping over here. And, you know, we don't really want to dictate how they do that, so we're just going to separate out. We're not going to let the government create a national church for the United States. We're not going to let that happen. We're going to let some religious freedom within these bounds happen. It was keeping the state out of the church, not keeping the church out of the state, right? That's really what that was about. Totally changed in today's political culture. And this is why you did not have in America in those early days when literally tens of thousands of people were moving to America for religious freedom. You didn't have, you know, persecuted Muslims or Jews moving to America in the 1600s or the 1700s or even into the 1800s because they would not have been free to worship in their way. They simply wouldn't have been. It would have been run out. Or they would have been forced to hide it. So while the New England colonies all trace their roots to the Puritan movement, it was never a standardized movement. There was always a lot of splintering there, but more of a general descriptor of a lot of people who had some common goals. So the Puritans helped get America started, in part to express themselves religiously, but a good percentage of them are just as intolerant as their old oppressors back in England. Many a Baptist was persecuted for their beliefs about baptism. Right? Whole congregations asked to leave. And just to make things interesting, at one point the king in England forms the colony of Maryland as an entirely Catholic colony, right? Right, Maryland, exactly. Before you know it, half a dozen forms of Puritanism that arrive on the shores of America splinter into a dozen, splinter into 50 or 60, splinter into hundreds of groups, and that keeps on going until we get to today when we need books like this, The Handbook of Denominations in the United States, 11th edition.
It's pretty thick.
And look at this thing, right? I mean, I look at, let me just for fun here, I'll just look up one group here. It's always fun to look at the, you've got things like the Millennial Dawn People, the Missionary Church, the National Primitive Baptist Convention,
the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. You've got, where is it? The Baptist one is always funny to look at.
I'm saying that as a guy who grew up in a Baptist church, so I can make fun of them. There's like 400 types of Baptists in America. Just in America, right? But that's what we were started in, right? That's the interesting thing. So you've got these dissidents from England coming over here and saying, screw it, we're doing it our own way. But wait, there's 12 of us, and we have 12 different ways that we want to do it. So great, so we got 13 colonies, we're all set, right? Right? I mean, it's just that's kind of what we were founded in. This multiplicity of religious expression has marked the church culture in America up to today, and it all started with the Puritans. Is the baseline there. It's the reason why we go into that conversation. Questions about Owen, Puritanism, that I can try to answer? I actually did a lot more study on the Puritan era than I had time to get into tonight. So there might be some other questions on that I can answer. If you would like to study the Puritan era a little more, I would recommend Justo Gonzalez's books on Christian history, The Story of Christianity. Great books. If you ever want to, like just a great overview of Christian history, it's a two-volume work called The Story of Christianity by Justo, or looks like Justo or Justo Gonzalez. Definitely the most easily readable books on church history that you'll ever find. Like it's so easy. It's like bathroom reading. You just want to like sit there and read all day. It's great. Good stuff. Questions about Owen and Puritanism?
The Puritan movement in America basically became the Congregational Church.
That's right. Yeah. It largely expressed itself as the Congregational Church, where everybody had a vote. Not a shock that we come to American democracy. And if you're in the New England states, that's still very strong in just about every church expression there. Almost all churches in New England are going to have a congregational stance of some sort. And what's interesting is, in many cases, it's actually written into the state laws over the way a church can be incorporated. There has to be a certain number of officers, and there has to be a certain frequency of votes. Like you have to bring together the congregation like once a year and have a business meeting, and you have to have a quorum there. And now many of those churches in more recent years, as people have in my own personal view rediscovered what I would see as a biblical form of church government, which is elder-led. Many people have moved away from that, even in New England. So you've got a lot of old congregational churches that are disbanding the congregational form of government and moving more towards a pastor or elder-led congregation. So, yeah. But actually, that's a whole denomination. It's a congregational. But even like most Baptist churches function congregationally. Other questions?
Bill, you made a few references to Arminianism. What is Arminianism?
So in the context there, the question is, what is Arminianism? And in the context, I'm placing Arminianism up against Calvinism, right? And I'll boil this down to its most basic idea, because it's a huge discussion. But in basic terms, Calvinists would say, and I'm a Calvinist, right? So would say that your salvation is dependent on God's work in your life. An Arminian would say that there is an aspect of your salvation that you bring about. Am I representing that right, Jeff?
I might have put it in slightly different words.
Well, you're more of an Arminian than most here, so
more
you.
About free will.
Yeah, okay, that's another way to say it is free will versus.
Free will versus determinism.
Right.
Calvinism says that your salvation has been preordained or predetermined. Salvation or not, it's been preordained or predetermined by God.
Right.
Well, Arminianism recognizes that it requires the work of God in your life, but that you have the ability to reject that work and thereby have a role in it.
Right. Yep. So we'll be getting into that a lot in this study. Okay? All right, other questions?
Anything else? If there are no other questions, any questions about the overall study, anything at all before we finish up? All right. Good. Hey, Bruce, can I ask you to close us in prayer? You can do it.
I had a question first.
All right, ask your question, and then you can close in prayer.
You had modern and pre-modern, you said, at the very beginning.
Yeah. You're going to ask me for the years, aren't you?
Well, or roundabout, where I've never really...
Yeah, it's a little funky where you break it. But if you, it really kind of falls on, you could also say Enlightenment era or pre-Enlightenment era, if that helps a little bit. Anybody know the exact years on that? I'm terrible with years.
No, I don't even think the historians agree.
Really. Yeah, they kind of...
Depends on how you date it.
I think typically, I think you can say like once you're into the like 1700s, yeah. You're into...
18th century through the 20th century is definitely considered the modern era.
Right.
And anything prior to that, you're starting to get into... It's not really, you know, you're starting to transition towards a more medieval...
Right, and some would
like
say...
Even in the Reformation, Luther, for example, that was definitely not the modern era.
But he's acting a little bit modern.
He's acting modern, but he's really... Some people consider him really more medieval than the way he looked at the world. Like the Enlightenment was beginning, but it really hadn't... He's acting modern in that he's advocating for the individual's interpretation of the Bible.
He's acting a little bit scientific.
But a lot of his roots were very not modern.
Yeah.
Well, there's a debate as to whether we're still in the modern period or not.
Well, okay, so the debate is, most people would say we're in the postmodern era. And so postmodernism, like if you ever gone into an art gallery and you see like art that just looks like some 4-year-old threw paint on the wall,
yep.
Right? Like that's postmodern art, okay? So people say we're in the postmodern era, which impacts art, it impacts literature. The postmodern era says, who really knows what is truth? We can just define truth on our own. You know, we don't need any source of authority to define that. But there are those who would say that postmodernism is actually just ultra-modernism. It's funky. So I think because we're in it right now, I don't think we're going to know for a couple hundred years, to be honest with you. I think people will look back and it may be a blip. I don't know. So
that kind of helps.
Yeah. But like the modern era versus pre-modern era, think like, you know, scientific method. Is modern era. Pre-modern era is, you know, look at the stars and, I don't know, take some juju bees. I don't know. Like right, it's like it's more like witch doctor kind of stuff, right? It's more, you know, holistic or something. Modern era is, I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't want all the crunchies getting on my case. Modern era is going to be like more about like mechanizing things and making things in a sort of a putting things into categories. Study is going to get sort of more rigorous in a chasing down ideas rather than kind of looking at things a little more globally. Some of those are distinctions. All right? Good? Trivia has started. It gets a little bit louder here once trivia starts. Bruce, close us in prayer.